piece of territory that was being staked out. And it precisely contradicted, I mean, it was completely contradictory. And, I mean, that's what seems to me is very dangerous and very problematic, is to get involved in making, you know, in elaborating or stating strategies that in which one is not engaging, basically, at that moment.
She did pretty well. But I know some of you have seen it. Did anyone else? You didn't see. There was this series of panels, and they were very academic as a rule, and they were on certain topics that were more or less kind of politically correct. And people got there, and I was really disappointed because they ended up really degenerating. Hal Foster, who organized this, said he really wanted to emphasize dialogue, right? But there was no way in hell there was going to be dialogue in that space and in that setup. It was this really scary-looking room that looked like, you know, Starship Enterprise or something. And there was, like, you know, all the audience was sitting down. They couldn't see each other. And then this, you know, podium-like thing. It was really intimidating. But it ended up just degenerating into this sort of either empty polemics in the way that, like, someone up here would say something stupid and everyone would be, like, you know, from the audience, like, taking pot shots at that person to try and make them look even more ridiculous. Or it would be someone in the audience maybe who was being referred to would feel personally challenged in a way that would be detrimental to their career. So they were having to kind of defend their thing. So it really was totally unproductive, I thought, and I had the misfortune or the fortune or whatever of giving one of the things. And afterward, I got confronted by someone who basically accused me of trying to stake out a certain territory, which I was, you know, maybe self-deluded enough to not realize I was doing, but it really stunned me and it made me really unable to do what I had originally intended to do here, which was, you know, give more of a prepared statement. I just couldn't deal with that after the Dia thing and after feeling that it had nothing to do with discussion, it had nothing to do with ideas. It was I much prefer what's going on in this room, which seems to me more about potentially, you know, real things maybe emerging that are about talking with each other than I am in what was going on there, which was all about a kind of like in the animal kingdom, you know, sort of puffed up feathers display of
Well, I mean, just the thought, as Amy was talking about, do you find this accusation of trying to stake out a territory is more often applied to women than men?
That's a good point, because generally it would be more applied to marginal groups who aren't given that territory by birth or whatever. So the rest of us are clawing for what little crumbs in the margins we can get. That may be true. But I think in general, when you deal with academics in the art world, I mean, I went to this thing in 78 that was supposed to be a feminist conference, and I couldn't call myself a feminist for 2 years after that, because here I was so idealistic, thinking that we're going to talk about ideas, you know, we're going to get some stuff done. And it was everyone just reading their paper and trying to get an academic job, which is good. I mean, you know, maybe they really deserve the academic job, but it had nothing to do with the kind of lofty ideals of intellectual debate that they were claiming it did. So I don't know. I'd rather just talk about stuff and not, you know, not have to make it in this way. But I guess the structure is, you know, we're the catalysts. Maybe
yeah,
that's it.
But I think that's all right for this context. I mean, we're talking about ambivalence and lots of people can participate in that.
Right, well, we're all ambivalent about being up here.
Right. Jim?
Yeah. I wanted to go back, Leslie, when you were talking about, I mean, it sounded to me what I heard was you wanted the film to sort of be, you know, at a point where people begin talking. I sort of can accept that. You know, it did seem like throughout sort of problematized the whole, you know, its ability to name things. Mm-hmm. also set up a lot of situations which, you know, where it sort of dramatized, you know, that, you know, incapacity or that refusal, or at least that sort of slowdown in a process of, you know, quickly naming. Although I really agree with Andrea too that there's this, I mean, if you know, the president saying, you know, my management style, I don't know what's going on below me, that's beyond my knowledge.
Yeah.
That just seems like the ultimate version of claiming loss of knowledge in the favor of power.
Well, I'll tell you what, this sort of actually fits in nicely to what we're just going to discuss. The ideal situation, in my mind, for this work in terms of screening is for it to be there as the bad, crippled thing that it is, and then to talk about it so that what it doesn't say can come out amongst people immediately following, and not from me, although since I know it best, you know, and certainly have lots of opinions about it, I'm going to be dealing with that. But that it was a film that was made to be followed with discussion very much. So you know, I don't want to, I wouldn't be comfortable leaving this room saying only this is sort of empty and mute and doesn't do it. That's the point. That's what that does, and then you work around that. Like, what's that about? You know,
yeah, what is?
I can't relate to your state. I can't relate to it. I think it doesn't relate. I can't respond to it if anyone else here has an interest in responding. It's not something that registers at all. I cannot relate to it.
Well, I just think there's a fundamental critique in the very, very opening, which is, what are you looking at? Are you looking at Chinese people? Are you looking at women? Or are you looking at the way they are imaged in our culture? And if you can't get around that reversal, if you can't find some discomfort in the way the film is structured, then of course you're going to take it as in a merely consumer way, you know, as a reinforcement.
No, it's fine. I don't think the problem with Reagan is his ambivalence. I think it's his lack of it, you know? I mean, he knows exactly who's right and who's wrong and who's got the white hat and the black hat, and he knows where he stands, and, you know, I think if that guy had a, you know, little tiny bone of ambivalence in his body, you know, maybe this whole thing with the Contra Gate wouldn't have happened. No, you know, ignorance, stupidity, incompetence, that's another story. I don't think that's got anything to do with ambivalence.
Well, maybe I shouldn't, like, make such a dramatic comparison. Since I don't think... I mean, I think the slowing down of ascribing the proper name. I mean, I see your work, Amy. I get kind of like excited about that too. But
excited in what way?
Well, I think of it like in a jar, like Alfred Jarret would have like speeded up, you know, to some kind of insane data destructive level, some kind of, instead of picking on a, you know, a kind of, like he did with a Shakespearean play, you pick on these kind of mass cultural, you know, American modes of whatever sexuality, you know, the kind you get on the FM radio. And to me, I mean, you rev those up. You take the position of authority, and you kind of, it misfits. Because, I don't know, I mean, this is my version. But you take it on, and it just kind of, you know, it just goes kind of crazy.
don't know if I take it on. I mean,
it breaks down for me.
It what?
It breaks down.
Good.
It's sort of in a kind of destructive way, you know, in a totally, you know, like blow the whole house down. But
yeah, I just, in a way, I'm very self-critical, and I mean, they're really ironic, because at the same time that I'm setting up this work, which is about a kind of fascination and repulsion in my own life, I mean, you know, I'm totally mushball, and I totally buy a lot of the things that I would never, you know, mm-hmm. kind of intellectually want to admit. And I think that we're also constructed by mass culture. I mean, at a certain formative point, I was reading all of these, you know, true romance magazines from the supermarket, and they're just disgusting. They're really, like, freaky. But they touch some real, you know, kind of psychoanalytic nerves in the populace. And I mean, if you want to do work about desire, I think you have to touch those nerves, even if only to make people aware of what you're dealing with. But I really want to push the edge of horror a little more in my work. My next series, I mean, I'm moving from bedrooms to hells. And the hell things, I've been collecting a lot of monsters that money can buy. Mm-hmm. And I've been looking at a lot of special effects horror movies and reading a lot of like Stephen King and stuff like that. So I'm getting really interested in some of these other really powerful nerves. This guy, Jim Cameron, who directed Terminator and Aliens, he says stuff like, you know, fear is a really important emotion because it makes people feel like they're alive. You know, that's what they're saying, you know, in Hollywood and stuff. So, I mean, they're using certain knowledges on Madison Avenue and in Hollywood and so on to manipulate us. And I just kind of want to deal with the results of that.
Well, I think
Well, I was just thinking about the use of music in Leslie's piece as opposed to Amy's. And Leslie's, there's this, we talked about this trace of correspondence, but also a real contradictory sense to the music in terms of mood. And in Amy's work, it's like the music is used almost in a literary way, like you have to hear the words in order to hear what, in order to deduce the relationship between the image, the construction and the music. And I wondered if you had ever considered using music that had a different kind of relationship to the objects.
Oh yeah, I mean, this series, I wanted to be,
rather than undercut it, because in a sense the music really does.
Yeah.
It keeps you distanced from really losing yourself in the.
Well, you can't understand the words in the opera boxes, so it ends up being like mood music. But in this new work, I wanted to be as literal as possible, and I really wanted to use the tackiest puns and cliches when I organized it. You know, like the jealousy box is green, and it plays "I Heard It Through the Grapevine" by Marvin Gaye, and it has all this green plants, and you know, I mean, I really wanted to be as stupid as possible and kind of, you know, not make any accusations about the mass mind, but just, you know, sometimes those things are I mean, they're kind of dumb and obvious because they work. I don't want to talk about it. So, Andrea.
Oh, wait, no, Tom.
Okay.
Actually, I had one comment. There's one thing that to some extent distresses me, and it comes up in the relationship of language to the work that we looked at today, and the kind of role that's imputed to that language. It seems to me that if you carry the metaphor that's been current here, that you have a series of in institutions, certainly within academic institutions, in the art world in general, a series of constant, incessant territorializations, re-territorializations, deterritorializations, that the problem begins to be one of, in such a situation, in such a context, what kind of language, what form of address is effective. And that's why I mean, your statement about mm-hmm. language and just like Reagan, that language can be used to cover things up, which, you know, certainly in some places, some extent must be true, but I wouldn't object to here. And yet it does really throw a light on the problem. It really is a matter of what kind of, how do you what form of address do you employ in a situation where people are addressed in terms of their life?
I can hopefully protect the language that the two of them are working on, of posing images against other images and cutting and using these and experimenting. I think we'll get to experiment. I think that's hopefully, well, that's a form of I'm hoping to take.
No, I would agree that it makes sense that we have addressed that language. In fact, the question is a great devil's advocate question, I think, too.
Well, I think Andrea's done more work on language than either of us, because you've been interested literally in doing that, of taking bits of writing and setting them off against each other. And then, again, twisting that relation once more, when you speak them in a kind of performative way, and very different voices and demeanors. She's doing much more for words, in a way, than images. Although when you worked with images, you were using some of those strategies as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting his comment, though, because I think it's one of the questions being raised is the choice of what do you gather together to help encounter this issue of strategies of representation, and if you gather together words as part of what you're offering to look at this set of issues. I mean, it's interesting to me that the bulk of what we've all talked about has been the two pieces of work where we had essentially something separate from the person and their speech to look at, and therefore could add our words to it with some sort of safety and distance. I don't know, because I think the things you raised in your presentation seem to be the center of a lot of things we talk about, yet we don't address them to your talk. I wonder how much that has to do with what you're saying of choosing words as the medium through which you're addressing. I don't have any idea of a simple picture of that relationship, but something seems to be up there, I think. Do you?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, in a way it would seem that the aim of my practice would be opening up discussion or at least stretching the framework in which that a discussion could take place and what could be discussed. But at the same time, it also, no one ever asks questions when I'm giving a gallery talk, right? I mean, it's just sort of an impossibility. There's no, it seems, I mean, I would imagine,
there's
in
no
the way that I would
there.
Think that it would be experienced, that there's no place to which to address a question.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's kind of, and in a way I'm kind of uncomfortable with that as well. But it's, but I guess what I was talking about in the talk about the talk, and which is sort of central to me, I think, is the not eliciting response, not making a demand, okay, now we'll talk about this, or these are a set of terms. So I think that's also what sort of might make it difficult to address, or I mean, I hope it would make it difficult to address as well.
Do you
not being very clear.
Talks with people who are familiar with what you're up to, or are they generally groups of people who are unfamiliar?
It's mixed. The way that the gallery talk was set up was that I was in the show and my name was on the wall at the entrance to the gallery, but I didn't have anything in the gallery, and there was just a sign in the lobby that said New Museum. Damaged Good Gallery Talk starts here. And so there was no connection between Andrea Fraser, who was an artist participating in the exhibition, and this gallery talk. So, but there are people who knew about it, and it actually became a cheap thrill in the voice. Saying that it was a performance. So, but there was a mixture of people. There would be people who wanted to hear a gallery talk. There would be people who wanted to hear a performance. There would be people who just happened to be in the gallery and didn't want to hear anything and didn't know what was going on. And I mean, but eventually, ideally, I mean, the audience is the person who wants to hear a gallery talk. But that's not really the audience. And I don't know exactly how to deal with, or what exactly would be the other demand, in which I was not a docent, or Jane Castleton was not a docent, but Jane Castleton was a production of Andrea Fraser, who's a performance artist. I mean, that's like something which I think is really a problem. I mean, how I think about what I'm doing is that I don't know how to address that. And maybe, I don't know, maybe I do.
Well, you're pushing it toward an even weirder end. I mean, Jane Castleton was Jane Castleton the whole time that you did that piece at the museum, but when you did the piece in the Fairy Tale show, she did a docent tour for this show at Artist Space, and you dealt with all that stuff from like the Mies Commission and actually changed voices, changed personas in the middle, and you know, people were wondering, you know, people who would come to the new museum and, you know, would see Jane Castleton, they might actually, you know, for a while, think that it was a regular docent tour if they hadn't gone to one before, except, you know, well, why is she talking about the security system? Why is she talking about the bathroom door, you know? But other than that, you know, there was a certain kind of coherence about your presentation, whereas in the other one, I mean, there were times where you were just sort of totally off on this, like, screaming fit, and then you'd be really calm the next second, and, you know, I'm sure people wouldn't dare ask you a question afterwards because they wouldn't know which person they would get. But one of the things I want to say is when you're dealing with a situation like this one, I did find it curious that, you know, people were talking about me and Leslie together because we dealt with the Magistic stuff, but you were sort of somewhere else. And I think it's because in a context of dealing with images, language is usually assumed as being more or less transparent. I mean, maybe if we were poets and you had done that thing, people would have called into question language more. And that really bothers me about talking about art. You know, that people assume the words act as some kind of caption which pins the image for one or another form of truth. And I think that it's really good to have, you know, with the Magistic people, someone who's really working on, you know, the ways in which art is addressed at the same moment. I think that was a good stroke of...
Well, I mean, it just... I think it's important not to distinguish, so... I mean, to say there's representation and there's language. Language is a form of representation. I mean, one represents with language.
But you'd be surprised at what people
myself
can say that and then forget
speaking
about it when they're talking about
right
art.
Right. Yeah.
There are all those reminders we placed with images that, I mean, we're so accustomed to the reminders that this is somehow a more complex presence than just a simple face. And those reminders aren't present when somebody is speaking, except you consciously develop them by changes in attitude and changes in demeanor, which helps sort of clue the listener that something is up here. But I think you're right that without that we can all think, oh, of course we know language is representation, but that as I say those words, they are transparent.
Good.
Yeah, I just want to say, suggest to Andrea that I'm a little bit confused about relegating what Andrea does to really topically addressing language again, as what Amy just said. I just wanted to know, I mean, to a certain extent, it's a pictorial activity. It's a process.
Oh,
it's a pictorial activity. It's a process of imaging. It's not really. It seems perhaps that I just want to suggest that maybe it's not merely about pointing to what circumscribes what was present in the museum, but recontextualizing it and opening up a certain set of spaces and a possibility of response. To the extent that it's pictorial, is that it's about imaging or re-imaging or de-imaging.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's...
Well, All I said was that she has taken as her stated aim, you know, to kind of deal with the discourses that are used to describe art. I mean, that's the whole point of a docent lecture.
But it's all.
Well, it's not actually.
I mean, it's just an instance.
Right.
And that's what I was saying at the end, is that.
But that's just, you sort of end up falling prey for people's assumption that the language can kind of explicate the work in a certain way.
I don't think so, because I think it's more about being a speaking subject than it is about, you know, language as having like an explicative function.
Yeah.
You know, language as explaining art, I think it's more how art is spoken through and how people speaking about art are spoken through.
Actually, Andrea's presentation was most instructive and perhaps even a bit insidious, because it does pull out a certain thread that ties together all three presentations, and it operates under the name and the appellation of something that usually you find in thinking about written texts or spoken utterances, and the word is quotation. That all three works seem to deal with various ways and means of quotation, some of which would, in a very curious way, actually exceed precisely a speaking subject or a particular authorial or even speculative position. Some of which reside entirely within that and do sort of insidious tricks, like Andreas, who quotes herself quoting somebody else quoting herself, and who operates, I think, really quite beautifully, this constatative and performative shift. And you know, sets up all sorts of little traps there, in a way not dissimilar to the way that the little traps that we found in Amy's boxes, little traps from the ideas of his film. So that's possibly one way, one thread, one approach into a common theme among all the differences in these three works.
Actually, that might be a good place to end. And if people want to stay and talk, please do. Whatever time is up.